Since you guys are all here on time, I guess we can go ahead and get started. It is my pleasure to get to introduce today's speaker. I think I know most of you here, but if not, I'm Yvonne Lee, and I get to introduce Dr. Lynette Henderson. She has been a friend and colleague of mine for a good while, so this is very nice to get to do. Lynette received her master's from Belmont University in 1992, and her PhD from the Department of Special Education at Peabody here at Vanderbilt in 2000. And most recently, she completed her postdoctoral training with Dr. Wendy Stone with the Triad Program in 2005. And currently, I think several of you met her just a few weeks ago. She is the, the Kennedy Center Research Participant Coordinator and a Research Assistant Professor here at Vanderbilt in the Department of Pediatrics. And her talk today is going to be on a tool that a lot of us have been trained on and find extremely useful. It's a screening tool in autism. So her topic is today, the screening tool for autism in two-year-olds, the utility of the STAT for one-year-olds. So we appreciate your coming for today's talk.
Thank you, Yvonne, for agreeing to introduce me. And I'm very excited that you're all here and are interested in what we're going to do today. So let's get busy. I want to acknowledge right off the bat our funding sources. They include DOE, the NAR Mentor-Based Postdoctoral Research Fellowship that brought me here, and then the NICHD study of early social orienting, which is continuing now, that Dr. Stone, Walden, and Yoder are currently working in. So today, I'm going to do a brief description of the STAT. We're going to talk about what our research aims and questions were. We're going to talk about our approaches and some of our results, and then we're going to talk some more about the future work that we need to do. So the STAT is the screening tool for autism in two-year-olds, and it was developed by Wendy and Opal Owsley. I should know that. I realized I have never said that name out loud. It's developed for ages 24 to 36 months. It's designed as a level 2 screen, which means we already have a suspicion that something's going on with this child. Now we want to know, is it autism or is it just developmental delay? And so it's mostly used for referral settings. It's designed to sort those children into two groups, at risk for autism, developmental delay. It is interactive. It's very play-based. It takes about 20 minutes to administer, which is both a plus and a minus in terms of thinking about implementing it widely. The items were derived empirically from a database of two-year-olds with and without autism, and it consists of 12 items, and they assess play, communication, and imitation. And the items are scored live by the examiner. So as the examiner interacts, in that moment, she decides pass-fail or refuse, and marks that on a page by her knee or wherever she's working or he's working. So the STAT items, 2 play items, 6 communication items that are divided into 2 that are focused on getting the child to request, looking at the requesting behaviors, and then 4 that are designed to elicit directing attention behaviors, getting the child to really show you or communicate with you about the objects in their space. And then the last 4 are motor imitation items. So the 2 play items start out with this sort of open-ended group of toys. And it starts off with, we're looking for functional play with the doll or the bear. And that the doll or the bear is handed to the child multiple times to see what they'll do with it. Some ways to pass are to feed the bottle to the doll or the bear, to put the doll or the bear into the bed, to put the doll or the bear into the chair, any combination of those kinds of things. In addition, we also do an interactive turn-taking play thing with a ball or a truck. And again, we try to see if the child will play back and forth with us. There are 4 imitation items, and that include rolling a car, vroom, 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 hopping an animal, beep, 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 beep. So it's an odd sound that doesn't really go with animals, which is why it's not something that children will have been exposed to before. and then shaking the rattle, and then drumming hands, which is like an alternating thing, like bam, 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 bam. Then there are six communication items. Two are requesting, and four are directing attention. These are the things that you would use with them. You see an opaque bag, and it has three toys inside of it. A sparkle wand that has glitter and sparkly things inside of it and in a liquid so it kind of floats around. And then a stuffed animal, small stuffed animal, and a rubber snake, a really realistic-looking rubber snake. And then there are also some balloons and bubbles and food. Bubbles and food are requesting items. And then there's a puppet that the examiner puts on her hand. It kind of pretends not to notice that she goes on writing and doing things with her hand with the puppet on it to see if the child will go, "You're doing something very odd," you know, because most children know that, you know, with a puppet on your hand, it's not supposed to be your hand anymore. And then there's also a noisemaker. That's what the little gun-looking thing is. It makes noise and is hidden, so the child is going, looking around for, where did that noise come from? So, an example for requesting is we give the child a desired object, either food, treats, or bubbles, in a sealed jar with a tight lid, and then we look for these kind of behaviors. So does the child point or reach to get that object that they want? Do they hand the examiner a jar to ask for help? And we look for whether any of those things are combined with eye contact or vocalizations. And we also, one of the things that we see in children with autism is they will take your hand and put it on the jar to say, "Do this," because they're using your hand as a tool. So, some examples of directing attention, this bag of interesting toys, or the balloon, we blow it up and then you go 1, 2, 3 and you let it fly, and so it makes some noise and a lot of spectacle. And so then again, you're looking for pointing, nice eye contact combined with this one, or some facial expression. Sometimes we do things that some children don't like the balloon, but that facial expression is communicating. And then also some pointing and other kinds of good eye contact combinations. So given that you now have a sense of what the STAT is like, I just want to briefly review what has been published to date about the psychometric properties of the STAT with two-year-olds. So it has been shown to have good sensitivity and specificity. The closer to one sensitivity is, the better we like it. The specificity, again, the closer to one, the better we like it. The more balanced the two are, the more...
What's the gold standard that you're comparing sensitivity and specificity to, the ultimate diagnosis?
Yes, clinical and ADOS. I'm going to get to that in just a minute. Thank you. Good question. And then positive predictive value and negative predictive value. These four things give us the best information about how well our screening test works. And they were showed, it even improved in the validation sample, which is what you like to see. So showing that it wasn't sample specific, that it works in more than one group of children. Reliability, test retest was very good, and risk category, the Kappa was also very good, using the ADOS as the gold standard, and ADOS and clinical judgment. Inter-observer agreement, very good. Here's the agreement between the STAT and the ADOS, which is the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, which is one half of the gold standard. It's the observational piece of the gold standard for autism diagnosis. And we see that it was very good. And this has all been previously published. So, to get to our research aims, we wanted to identify a scoring algorithm that could be used for children under 24 months. And so the first question was, is there anything we need to change about the STAT? Does the STAT as it currently exists work for younger children? And then specifically, are there particular items that work better or don't work at all? And then question two, is the current scoring algorithm, how well does it work in this population? And if not, how should we change it? So we first administered the STAT to a pilot sample of children, and we found that younger children still like to play with all the things that we do. They can do most of them. They had a good it's still a good context, even for those younger children, for looking at social and communicative behaviors. And we also found that for the first time we were really testing children with typical development, and we found that for many of them, they needed a little bit more time to warm up, and they might need their parent in the room maybe even more than a child with autism, because they were not familiar with situations where they just went into a room and mom left and they were supposed to play with a stranger. And so we found that we had to even add a different toy play warm-up to some of the stats for the typically developing children. So that told us a few things about even looking at the approach to how well the person interacts is a useful thing. And we also looked at this bigger pilot sample to look at pass and fail issues. And again, some items were failed more consistently by younger children because the pass standard included some coordination, either physically, like the alternating hands, which was really difficult for younger children, or it required coordination of behaviors like a vocalization to pass when maybe some of the children between 12 and 18 months weren't vocalizing yet. And so it did suggest the need to look at the scoring system a little bit more carefully. So this is the percent of children passing items at different ages. Above 18 months, it's really good, with the exception of the noisemaker. But under 18 months, there's a lot more variability.
What's the aim?
Directing attention. That's the category of the STAT. There are four categories. That's the category. And this included typically developing children and children at risk. Okay. So then we decided that we really needed to look at the STAT in a mixed sample, like you would see if in sort of it was more real world. If we included children with TD, with developmental disabilities, with autism, and language impairments. And so we included some younger SIVs, some children with typical development. And so the younger SIVs are going to be our validation samples, so you'll see them in the next sample. And we found that sensitivity and specificity was pretty good, but not as good as the two-year-olds. So let me kind of show you this sample. So we had 39 children with ASD, 23 children.
Just define what they are, because I'm sure for Dr. Graham probably thinks it's a hole in the heart.
Okay. Autism spectrum disorders, okay, is a neurological disorder that includes primary social impairment with communicative impairments and frequently repetitive or restricted behaviors, but not necessarily before the age of two. We do diagnose with the ADOS, and these children all had a diagnosis that was based on the ADOS diagnosis as well as the DSM-4 diagnosis. So, and our sample includes children with pure autism and also those with a milder form, which is called PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. And so we were giving ourselves a real world problem. If we had just gone with true autism, it would have been really simpler because PDD-NOS is tougher to pick up. So we matched on mental age as best we could, even trying as hard as we couldn't find enough DD children who had lower mental ages. And our DD group does include children with language impairments, so developmental delay and language impairments. You can see the ranges here in terms of mental age. Now, chronological age, obviously there's a mismatch because the delays in mental age are going to produce that mismatch on chronological age. Any other questions about the sample? I really appreciate Dr. Edwards helping me do a better job. Good. Sometimes you get so far into it, you don't know what other people don't know. Yes, sir.
At what age does the ADOS sort of not make sense from the younger standpoint?
Yeah, we have found that it. The manual says down to 24 months. We have found it to be pretty good down to 18 months. Before 18, it depends on the child, though. If you have a very low mental age, the ADOS is not going to be as useful at 18 months. So there is a mental age confound in the ADOS. So one of the things that we do is we would follow up, because Wendy's work has, looking at some of what she's done, she's found that the diagnosis is most stable if it's made after 30 months. So she might say at 20 months, this is looking like autism, let's treat it as if, and then I want to follow up. Does that help? Good question, thank you. So we looked at our sample across different ages. So we included 15 to 23 month olds, and so 86 children without autism, 15 with, and our sensitivity and specificity. So as you can see, it gets better as they get closer to that 2-year-old age, and increase the specificity for sure. Because what happens is some of our children developmentally can't do what it takes to pass a particular item, and so we're getting some false positives. Excuse me. We are catching all the children who have autism, but we're also catching some that don't. Which, the nature of a screener is, you want it to over-identify, because you're not going to hurt children by giving them some extra speech language or something like that. On the other hand, we don't want to scare families by saying the A word if that's not going to be a good match. So, but a level 2 screener should have better sensitivity than specificity, but the specificity is still, until it gets above 80, we're not really happy with it. So obviously we have some work to do. So we decided we would retain all 12 items, and we definitely wanted to retain the live scoring format, but we wanted to refine the scoring criteria. And one of the ways to do that would be to look at the behaviors that children exhibited during the STAT to see if there were some behaviors that, in addition to the ones that we are already looking for on the STAT, could give us a view of what typically developing children did on the STAT that indicated to us we're not worried about them having autism, and yet their score would make us worry. And so we're saying, what are those behaviors that make us feel comfortable they don't have autism but don't show up on the current scoring? So we did some behavioral coding, and this was frequency-based. So we decided to look across the whole STAT behavior time frame, so the whole 20 minutes of videotape. And we decided that some of our guidelines were going to be, because we want to go back to a live scoring, then when we code on videotape, we're going to use our first read, first impression idea. There are lots of tools out for coding videotape that allow you to go second by second, frame by frame. We didn't want anything that detailed. We wanted it to be as close to live as possible. And so we really pushed ourselves to, if you couldn't code it after you had seen it 3 times, then it wasn't codable. We weren't allowed to go back and just, you know, really slow it down. So you'd say, what did you first think? That was what you coded. If you weren't sure, you checked twice more. If you couldn't decide after that, then you couldn't code it. We also decided, although the STAT currently does not include any counts or indication of stereotypical behaviors, restricted interests, repetitive interests, things like that, we decided that we wanted to see if that could be useful to us in refining the scoring. And so we decided to count some of the stereotypical behaviors. And then we had to decide, when are we going to count them? And so one of the rules that we said was, anything that we had seen 3 times, a typically developing child is going to do some weird stuff, things that look odd, or walk on their toes, or stare at their reflection in the mirror, or some, you know, they're going to do those things, and that's fine. But the third time they do it is when it starts looking strange. And so we decided that we made an a priori decision. After the third time is when we start counting it as repetitive. And we also basically talked amongst our coding group and said, you know, it has to be qualitatively different. It has to make you go, after you know. And this basically required a certain amount of familiarity with lots of children with autism and what looks odd to you or not. And so that was sort of how we developed the codes.
What are some fairly typical stereotypic behaviors in little kids with autism?
Do you mind if I put that off for one or two slides? Thank you. So we also decided we would look at situation specifics. So we said, are there certain things that children do when they have the bag of toys? Like, a lot of typically developing children will look into the bag of toys to see what's in there. We don't see a lot of children with autism doing that. Was that meaningful enough? So we decided to count it. We also counted when they are playing with the doll or the bear. Do they look into the doll or bear's eyes and recognize its faceness? And we counted that. Some of which, you'll see that these don't show up again because they didn't end up being as useful as we hoped. But we looked at them. And we also looked at eye contact and affect during turn-taking and imitation, because we thought that one thing that was not being captured currently was, right now you get a pass or a fail if it goes back and forth three times on the turn-taking. But there's no indication of whether I know I'm supposed to do this or this is really fun, you know. There, and that's qualitatively very different. And so we wanted to try and to capture those two qualitatively very different experiences of, I'm doing this because I know I have to, which sometimes kids with autism will do, or I like this so much, you know, that is so not autistic. And then we also decided, under the stat scoring, you can only give a child credit for directing attention if they show you something during a directing attention item. But a lot of times they will show you the baby doll during play, or they'll show you the rattle during imitation. And we said, you know, they should get credit for showing, even if it isn't during the directing attention part. And so we decided to look to allow more opportunities for passable behaviors. All the interclass correlation coefficients are above 0.80 for all of the codes that I'm going to be talking about today. We didn't include any that weren't. And most of them were in the 90s. And so we were surprised, Wendy was definitely surprised, that we were able to get so reliable on some of our pretty squirmy codes. So we reviewed the videotapes. For each item, we identified the behaviors that were demonstrated by most of the TD children and very few of the autism children. And then we were using signal detection to look for cutoff scores, and then we were going to validate that on a separate sample. So that's where we're headed. Okay, that surprised me. So here are our behaviors. So for example, a three-point gaze, this is when the child looks back and forth between an object and a person, or object-person-object, or person-object-person. And that's pretty simple. Give with an eye contact is, it's a give, but they're also saying, I want you to have this. Sometimes without eye contact, you're not sure if they're just pushing it away, but with eye contact, it's more intentional. Show is when a child holds something up for your benefit. Points with eye contact. We looked at both because pointing is something that children with autism don't develop naturally. Very few of them have a really nice point. And if they have been taught a point, they don't tend to do it with eye contact. So we thought that those two things would tell us something different. Reaches with eye contact, we also counted reaches in earlier versions. We started with 150 codes and got down to 25. So it was a process of several years. And then sharing positive affect, which is this is fun, I like it, that smile and eye contact. And then the restrictive repetitive behaviors include manipulating an adult's hand without eye contact. So that's that putting your hand as a tool, or you have the jar and they take your hand and put it on the lid and then they push you, kind of, so this is manipulating your hand as a tool. Atypical sensory behaviors included excessive mouthing, rubbing textures, sniffing things, sound seeking, staring in the mirror, or withdrawal behaviors, things like tactile defensiveness, things they wouldn't touch because a lot of times you'll have palms, they won't put things in, they'll hold it like this instead of in their hand because they don't like to have their palms in contact with something. If they had a big auditory reaction to any sounds, that was another atypical sensory behavior. Atypical body posturing included, this is our code, the way we wrote it, child moves trunk, arms, and or hands in a manner that is unusual or awkward relative to age. So included in this is toe walking, unusual gait, finger posturing, body tensing. So like sometimes you'll have children who will get excited and do this because they're excited. And that is an automatic, that's an automatic atypical because you just don't see that. Again, if they covered up their ears from the balloon sound, it's not really that loud of a sound, so that counted. I'm sorry, that was sensory. The balloon was, I flipped a line. Repetitive movements with objects or body. Extended period of flicking something or banging something, spinning it, spinning himself, bouncing his body or her body, running back and forth across room, that sort of thing is really not something we see typically. Typically developing children want to sit and engage with you. So, and then difficulty separating from objects. The child protests the removal of the object and then looks for, tries to get, or expresses distress in response to the removal even after you've tried to distract them and move on with something else. And so an example of that would be a child tries to climb onto a cabinet to obtain a food jar that was placed out of the reach. So, we put it up here high and he's trying to climb. I actually have a picture of one who his mom is sitting there in the floor and he's climbing up his mother to get to this food jar like she was a stool. That's very atypical behavior. Not the way he did it, because he wasn't interacting with her. He wasn't saying to her, "Mama, help," or looking from her to the jar so that she knew why he was using her as a stool. It was very atypical. So these are some of the group means for those behavioral codes. And our autism group, our DD group, our TD group, and then these were done with by controlling for mental age differences. And this is the post-hoc result after controlling for mental age. And so you see that three-point gaze and gives with eye contact are two of our better ones. Most differentiated from the TD, which was good to know, because actually we had never looked at the stat in typically developing children. So it was good to know that they really did behave differently on these things. I don't know how much time to give you to look at this. Give me a nod when you're ready to go on. Yes, sir.
What is the number in each cell?
39, 23, and 47.
No, I meant, what
is
that?
Oh, I'm sorry. That is mean and then standard deviation.
The mean frequency?
Mean frequency. Yes, we were counting. I apologize. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. It is the mean frequency. So you can see that children with autism, most of them did it less than once in 20 minutes. The mean was less than once.
And all of those are statistically.
And yes, the significant post-hoc results are all so if autism is greater, did it significantly less than typically developing, significantly less than DD, and DD significantly less than TD for three-point gaze. So we had by this time we had clearly found the behaviors that were useful. You have to understand that we got here from 150 different behaviors that we were counting. So, this is only the good ones. And then let me show you the one. So these are all the things that we would have expected, and indeed we did find that children with autism did all these significantly less than our typically developing children and significantly less than the DD children. And one of the reasons why that's important for one-year-olds is because in between 12 and 24 months, it's not always clear that all your DD children are going to be identified as having a developmental delay yet. And so that's one of the reasons why we wanted to look at that. Yes, sir?
Are the numbers in parentheses the standard deviations?
They are indeed.
So I noticed that they're all very large.
There's a lot of variability.
Yeah. So that means that even though we have statistically significant differences between the three groups, when it comes to effect sizes, they probably get washed out.
Well, one of the ways that we can look at that is to do look at cut scores about how they behave in terms of actually identifying the children with autism or not, which is what we do next.
Okay.
Boy, you're ahead of me all day today.
Sorry.
You're just too smart, Robin. All right, so then these are the behaviors that we would expect children with autism to do more often than our DD and TD children. And you can see that even the typically developing children do these behaviors on occasion. But for the most part, we did find that children with autism significantly more frequently exhibited these behaviors. Yes, Kristen?
I had a question about that earlier.
So oh, I'm sorry.
It seemed like the mental age for the DD was a lot greater than autism and TD.
We controlled for that.
Okay.
Yes. So, yes, thank you for bringing that up. We did control for mental age first. In both of these.
That's one standard deviation and two standard deviations.
It's one standard deviation.
They're all higher than the age.
Yes, they're big. There's a lot of variability within the groups. But the fact that even with all that variability, they were significantly different.
So that would be showing that they're not normally distributed.
They aren't. So, yes, so this is why we didn't use this as our final analysis. It was just on our way. And okay. So then we looked at how useful were these behavioral codes in finding the children with autism in those groups. And if we used these particular cut points that you find on the far right, could we adequately assign children to the correct groups? And I put the original stat there at the top so that you kind of have a basis for comparison, original stat scoring. And you can see that our best ones are three-point gaze and gives with eye contact. And that some of the others do sort of wash out. So just to kind of give you a sense, so for example, if a child pointed with eye contact at least once, then there was a 70% chance that they probably didn't have autism. I mean, you know, that worked to that extent. Pointing at all was actually more useful than pointing with eye contact, which kind of surprised us because we thought the combination would be more useful. But the younger children don't always combine, but they do point. Thoughts or questions about this? Again, we're not done. So we went on to look at combinations of the two best ones because we felt like that, according to test theory, any one item is not going to be as good as your whole test. And so we looked at two of the best ones in combination and did indeed see some improvement, but still not that much improvement over the original stat scoring. We clearly had a lot more information from the behavioral coding, but in terms of sorting children, it didn't give us that much of a leg up. So we decided to see how well these codes could differentiate in a different sample. We were looking at younger siblings of children with autism who are at heightened risk of developing autism. This was part of this early social orienting study. We saw 26 of them. We saw them between the ages of 12 and 23 months. The mean age was 17.9, and the mean mental age was 17.3 the first time we saw them. And we used the first stat we ever saw of them. We have multiple stats on these children because we saw them several months, but we used the first time we ever saw them for this. At follow-up, and that's why the number is so low, is because we've seen 26 at follow-up. We have a lot more coming. Three of the children had autism. Three had a developmental delay or a language impairment. And 10 were judged to be typically developing, and this was after 24 months.
Is this roughly the numbers you would expect from a population? Of those with some sort of autism?
Yeah, just a second. I'm doing the math in my head. 3 out of 26 is... The expectation is between 8 and 12%. So, yeah, that's about right. Is that right? I can't do a talk and do math too. Okay, so ours is a little higher. Yeah. Okay. We think over the long sample it will be lower. But these are the ones that we had coded on all the behavioral codes. So looking at these 26, we said how well do these particular measures sort the children into autism, not autism, and found that three-point gaze worked even better in this sample than it did in our development sample. So also did gives with eye contact. Those two things really did a good job of finding our children with autism and not including our children with DD. Points with eye contact, showing, reaching, not as good. Sharing positive affect was not as good. And our sort of negative behaviors, the behaviors that are more autistic-like, didn't do as good of a job as these positive symptoms, these positive behaviors that we would look for in typical children. Questions or thoughts about that? And then we did some combinations and again improved with the combination in terms of if they passed three-point gaze or gave with eye contact at least once for each of those things, we could really sort them very well. So what we concluded was that the stat is an excellent context for observing behaviors in children from 12 to 36 months. There are several behaviors that differentiated between the groups, but as you all helped me point out, there are issues in terms of the distribution and that make it clear that one particular behavior is not going to express everything we need. When we used a higher cutoff, which we did we tried some higher cutoffs for children under 24 months, that did improve the psychometric properties, and so we said clearly the current cutoff is not the best way to go for those younger children. And some specific combinations of behaviors appear to have some utility for early detection, but they weren't going to replace or do a better job than the current stat. So we had an answer, but we didn't like it, in that the stat worked pretty well and behavior worked pretty well, but neither one of them worked so well that you wanted to throw the other one out. And so some of the implications about that were if we go with new cutoffs, one of the things that we need to consider is that we need to make sure that we put less emphasis on specific functional skills, like having the motor control to do the alternating hands, which was you know, was a problem. Or we also wanted to put a new emphasis on non-typical behaviors versus the absence of atypical, of the absence of expected behaviors. So we wanted to see if we see these repetitive behaviors or this odd sensory or odd body movement, is there a way that we could incorporate that into our judgment during the stat? And then if we do, will it prove to be a better screener? And so some future considerations are, we want to determine the utility for prediction using a stabilized instrument, so in an at-risk population with expanded samples. So although we had 26 in our sibling group, we should have 75 by the time our study is over, and so we'll be looking at it again with that more complete sample. And it will also allow us to look at those natural outcomes. Sometimes it's very difficult for us as practitioners to understand what is a language impairment and what, because communication is such a big part of autism, and if a child is having difficulty with communication, is that autism or is it just language impairment? And so we wanted to look for ways that would help us understand that better. And we also wanted to get back to live coding, and so we decided we would try to refine those codes so that it would be easier to score live and develop some cut scores and recording systems so that the examiner is actually able to interact with the child and keep a record. But the pass-fail that the stat's currently using is easy to keep a record of, but it doesn't incorporate these other behaviors, but it's really difficult to score, to administer a live stat and keep a record of every time a child does a three-point gaze. On the other hand, you only have to count to one, so that's not so hard, but you have a lot of different things that you have to count to one for. So we were trying to go back and forth about how we wanted to do that. What we came up with is what we're going to call the expanded range stat. And we maintain the 12 situations, and but instead of having a pass, fail, refuse, we have moved to a range of behaviors. So now we have a 0, 1, 2, 3. 0 is the most autistic response to this situation based on all of our behavior that we've seen. So if they don't respond, if they are engaged in self-stimulatory behaviors when you're offering this opportunity to interact, that's a 0. The 1 is they're kind of trying a little bit, but it's not what we're looking for. It's not enough to pass. A 2, it includes the behaviors that would previously have been a pass, or other behaviors that indicate a willingness, an interest that typically developing very young children could do, but don't have the developmental capability to pass. And then 3 is the most typical, the most social interaction that one could expect given this situation. And so you sort of rank the children from 0 to 3 based on specific behaviors that we saw. And this allows for quicker coding because you can quickly find the behavior that the child just did and circle it. And where you circled it tells you what the score is. So it includes the variability that we found in the typically developing children. And we are very excited about what that might offer for the stat in terms of younger samples, and then also for older samples, because some children with autism, if they've been in early intervention, by the time they're 36 months, they start passing the stat even if they have autism because they've been taught those behaviors. But the way they pass it is still not as social as the way a younger, typically developing child passes it. And so we have a way of looking at hopefully teasing some of that out. Well, we're very interested in that. And we recently found out that we have someone who's willing to do all the coding, which involves going back and looking at 150 to 200 stats that we've collected over many years to see how well this new expanded range scoring would do. So we basically took what we learned from all the behavioral coding and what we already knew about what worked about the stat and combined them and made it, we hope, a much more sensitive measure. So I hope you'll look forward to hearing more about the expanded range stat. Wanted to put my contact information here. I wanted to mention that research goes on with children with autism and their younger siblings. And so if you, in your practice, meet people who have concerns about autism, please give me a call or an email. I can help find ways through research that we might can meet their needs. And I also want to say thank you to all the people who did the stats that we watched and helped and participated in the earlier documentation of the stats' reliability and validity. And then I also want to specifically mention the NAR project coders. Amber Sprouse was a volunteer from Lipscomb. Meredith Towns was one of our RAs. And Justin Lane is one of our RAs and soon to be a Peabody Special Ed graduate student who was the other primary coder on this project with me. Thanks so much to Triad and to the Kennedy Center, and particularly to the families who shared their time and their children with us. I want to thank them very much. They did some very important things for us. I'm willing to take questions at this time. If you've got sort of big picture questions, or if I need to go back to a slide, I can do that. Yes?
I guess this is sort of a big picture question.
Okay.
There's so much in the media, both in the medical and in the lay press, about rates of autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it going up? Is it not? Is it diagnosis? Is it just putting people in different categories? And so maybe if you could just shed a little light on sort of what the status of that information is, what is known, and so that we can perhaps understand what the truth is as opposed to what fiction might be.
Okay, but I'm going to call on Yvonne to help me too. If you'll go yes if you agree and no if I get off base, okay? So it's yes, all of the above, in that we do feel like that part of what we're looking at is a broadening of the criteria. It has definitely been broadened. You can see that in looking from the difference between DSM-3 to DSM-4. We'll leave out DSM-3R. It's definitely broader. People are more aware. And so we are catching the milder forms that went undiagnosed before. We are doing a better job of catching people early. I think that makes it seem like there's more.
Why are we doing that? Is it because the pediatricians and the teachers and the daycare people? I mean, is everybody...
Everybody's more aware. And we have and because of research like that's been done by Wendy and other colleagues, we have a better idea of what we should worry about. We also have put out some red flags and some checklist kinds of things of looking for, you should see some babbling, you should see some communicative gestures, you should see babbling, you should see at certain milestones. And I'm sorry, those are not in my head at this moment. I wrote them down, and now I've forgotten them. I'll tell you wrong, so I'm not going to get into more detail. I think that's been part of it. Given a choice between an MR diagnosis and an autism diagnosis, sometimes people emphasize the autism part rather than the mental retardation part. And so if children have both, they feel more comfortable with the label autism because they hear about it on the news and people seem to have, that seems to have more of a cachet, if there is such a thing, or maybe it feels like there are more services for children with autism. And certainly that, one of the major studies that's been done of incidence rates has been done in California. And it is very much complicated by the fact that autism label will get you a lot more services in California than MR. So that's a real complication of that study. What have I forgotten?
I think it's like COVID.
Okay.
I think some people are saying there may be something in the environment that we just don't know.
Yeah.
And maybe going on, but we just don't know yet.
If there are some environmental triggers.
It's a real battleground for vaccines, as you know.
I understand. We also, I know most of us scientists feel very confident in the IOM's study, and it's that is an issue that has been answered. It is true that the media and parents still feel very strongly that they don't feel answered, and I think that trying to look for a possible subset of children who have a specific weakness genetically that puts them at risk because of exposure to certain environmental causes, it may be worthwhile, but I don't think that it should. I think that, like the IOM says, we've spent all the money we need to spend on the link between autism and immunizations, and they basically came out and said that we've spent more than enough money on this. It's time to move on.
The STAT is a screening test for all today, but there isn't really an instrument to give a definite diagnosis to it. And so there is a variability in that diagnosis where you have different ranges of autism.
Well, I think we feel pretty good about the diagnosis at 24 months. It's more stable at 30, but we could make a provisional diagnosis as early as 18 with the ADOS, and at 18 months. So between 18 and 30 months, we would have a provisional diagnosis, and it depends on the child. There are some children who are clearly autistic at 20 months, and that's not going to go away. But the milder forms, we would watch longer to get. But we feel like we've got a pretty good test. Now, if you're talking the kinds of medical tests of, you know, dichotomous yes, no, you're right. We don't have that kind of test.
So I guess there's information that needs to be given to the parents because they talk about a screening test, but this is not a diagnostic test, but you might be using it as a diagnostic test.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that when we implement the use of the STAT, one of the things that has to be conveyed when we talk with the family about the STAT results is that it is a screening test, that it is likely to over-recognize children, you know, that may not have autism, but that, and what we say is, let's proceed now based on their strengths and weaknesses. And so what's more important than the label is meeting individual needs. And so if through the STAT and our other testing we see communication problems, then we're going to recommend speech-language therapy to work on communication. And if we see imitation problems, we're going to talk about playing imitation games at home. Please.
If they fail the STAT, you would recommend a diagnostic evaluation?
Yes. If they fail the STAT, you recommend that they have a diagnostic evaluation. That's the purpose. So, yes, sir.
I refer a child to a Tennessee Early
Intervention
Program.
Mm-hmm.
How good are they compared, basically, to the research setting that you're working on?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, because the director of the Greater Nashville TEIS is sitting here, and many of the TEIS service coordinators have been trained in the STAT and are now using the STAT to help them develop a plan for what developmental evaluations need to happen. And so the STAT is becoming part of the practice of the Greater Nashville unit of the TEIS. So that's one of the screening tools that they might use. Is that accurate?
The person that had the most training has just taken another position. So typically what happens if you refer to TIS, then they would try to come up with another place for an evaluation. So whether they would refer to child development or to one of the triad projects or to somebody else.
Because they're good, as you said. They know their limitations.
They do know their limitations. And they will, try if there are concerns from the parent or the service provider about autism, they may use the STAT to help disconfirm or confirm their gut feelings. And then they're going to, even if the STAT comes back okay, but the parent's still concerned, then they're going to go ahead and recommend a full evaluation. And currently, at least on our campus, the three ways to access that are through the Center for Child Development. If the person has insurance, go the medical route through the Center for Child Development. If there's also sometimes, depending on the age of the child, research studies that they can receive a full evaluation through. And then we also have a autism parent support and education clinic through the Kennedy Center, which is for children under 4, and it's for parents who are really interested not only in learning about their child's diagnosis, but how to help their child. And it's 3 visits the first visit is an evaluation. The second 2 are teaching the parents what this means and what they can do to help their child. And that's a fee-for-service with scholarships available. So those are the 3 options that we talk with TEIS people about and about parents when they call.
And I assume with insurance, we
well?
Yes. Yes. And so, you know, so 10 care as well. Again, the fee for service has scholarships. The less money the person makes, the more likely it is to be free. Or almost free, sorry. Yes.
Another important note is that many children with autism have developmental delays in other areas.
Yes.
So they can start getting help even before the autism is diagnosed through TEIS because
that's
they'll
true.
Be delayed in other areas.
Absolutely.
And that's also related to another issue, and that is, for another session probably, is are children with autism more alike or different from other children with developmental disabilities?
Yeah.
And in the very heavy autism places, they're often considered to be very different creatures. But it's an empirical question. Maybe a lot of the interventions that work with children with developmental delays would also work with children with autism.
It depends on the child with autism, is what we've seen. There has to be a certain level of awareness of the world and some sort of pre-learning skills, if you will, to that enable certain children to be able to take advantage of the kinds of incidental teaching and things like that happen.
Yeah, but
in
a child with MR without autism doesn't have those things either.
It depends on what they've got. So, I will close now. Thank you very much for your attention and great questions. And I appreciate you listening with me today. Bye.